Hey, Lev.
Hi, Gerald. Can you hear me?
I hear you fine.
Okay, great. So first, I want to welcome you to the show. We're here with Gerald Friedman. Gerald, you signed off your email to me. Jerry, how would you like me to refer to you?
Well, Jerry is fine among friends.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here with us today. We're here with Jerry Friedman, who is a professor of economics at UMass Amherst. And I want to talk today about regional disparities in American politics and economics. You wrote a piece in Dollars and Cents recently about these regional disparities. And I want to talk about the political implications of them. Following the Great Depression, the U.S. economy grew. Sort of the regions of the U.S. economy grew in concert. And then after the year 2000, there started to be some disparities. And maybe we could start first with sort of who or what is responsible for the growth, the even distribution of growth after the 1930s.
Yeah. Well, a little correction.
Please, yeah.
The different regions did not grow together at the same rate after the 1930s. The poorer regions actually grew faster.
Okay.
So the range narrowed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that was very unusual in the American experience. Going back through most of our history, there were some rich regions and some poor regions. Mm. Before the Civil War, the rich regions were the South, and the poorer regions were generally the North and West.
Mm-hmm.
The Civil War flipped that. And the South came out of the war and emancipation and Reconstruction and the adoption of Jim Crow and other policies that retarded economic growth. And the South, per capita income, average income in the South from the 1880s to the 1930s was kind of stagnant at about half the level of the North.
Mm.
The poorest states like Alabama and Mississippi had an income maybe a third that of the richer states like Massachusetts and Connecticut.
Wow.
Really reversing what had been the case under slavery. Now, the 1930s, things changed. They changed, not coincidentally, with the period of Democratic governance and Democratic dominance in American politics, because the South was in a, Southern whites were an essential part of the Roosevelt coalition, and they helped shape economic policies. And progressives in the North encouraged this because they looked at the South. I mean, I'm old enough to remember Bobby Kennedy going down to the Mississippi Delta and being shocked at the poverty down there.
Mm.
So Northern progressives wanted to promote economic growth in the South. Southerners, Southern whites, saw this to be their advantage, and Southern blacks, of course, favored it as a way of – they were the poorest of the people down there.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a variety of federal initiatives, the most famous being the military spending down South. The South was a major recipient, disproportionate beneficiary from military spending. Military bases were put in the South. Contracts were awarded to Southerners. But there were other economic policies. The free trade policy that the Roosevelt administration and through the Kennedy and Johnson years promoted had a major exception for textiles, because textiles was manufactured in the South and Southern manufacturers benefited. The Tennessee Valley Authority and other infrastructure investments by the government. NASA, you know, to my view, NASA should have its headquarters in Cambridge. But no, it's in Houston. What the? And there are other policies like that. And the result was to narrow the disparity between richer states and poorer states.
Mm-hmm.
This did not happen naturally, so to speak, as a result of laissez-faire or market competition. Market competition had not narrowed disparities in the past, and it did not account for the narrowing of disparities between the 1930s and the 1980s. You know, the North paid high taxes, and much of the money went south, and that benefited the economies of southern states and promoted faster economic growth, so that a place like Mississippi became, you know, not too bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like maybe 70% of income in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
South as a whole. Well, and one other piece here is the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Now, that was a latecomer, but it did add to the narrowing of disparities because, well, first of all, businesses were more comfortable moving south.
Yeah.
Because you weren't dealing with racism and open, you know, Ku Klux Klan activity. Secondly, southern states became more receptive to northern businesses. They had discouraged that before the 1930s and even before the 1960s because their fear was that northern businesses would try to change the social norms, the mores in the South, the
right.
Racism. So that gave an extra boost in the 1960s and 70s. There's a very good book about this by Gavin Wright, an economist at Stanford, sharing the prize about the economic benefits that the South got from the civil rights movement. Now, all this changes. It starts to change in the 80s. And where kind of the narrowing of disparities levels off. And since 2000, we've had a dramatic increase in disparities, almost back to the pre-New Deal levels. Now, some of this, of course, comes from the repeal or the backing off from many New Deal programs.
Mm-hmm.
Progressive income taxes that hit Connecticut and Massachusetts harder than Mississippi became less important under Reagan. In the 1990s, NAFTA finished the business of opening U.S. markets to free trade. The greatest effect of NAFTA on any single industry was on the southern textiles.
Mm.
Within a few years of the enactment of NAFTA, there were a million fewer jobs in southern textiles.
Wow.
And that devastated the working class in the highlands and the tidewater in throughout Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia, South Carolina, generally the reduction in military spending disproportionately hurt the South. The other big factor is with changing trade and with globalization and also just with economic changes in general, increased use of technology and automation, biggest beneficiaries were educated workers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are places in the South where you have clusters of such workers and where businesses have settled, drawing them from the North and from India and elsewhere. The Research Triangle in North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
Northern Virginia, a major center of technology, and also the Austin, Texas area.
Mm-hmm.
So those areas have done very well, and they basically look like the North.
Right.
But much of the rest of the South, still suffers from the backward educational policies that go back to slavery days.
Mm-hmm.
The South under slavery did not develop common schools the way the Northeast did.
Mm-hmm.
After emancipation, Reconstruction governments led by black politicians and Republicans, the Republican Party was very different back then,
mm-hmm.
Pushed for common schools, established systems of elementary, some secondary education. But after Reconstruction governments were overthrown by the Ku Klux Klan and white racists, the South moved away from universal schooling. Schools in the South received much less funding. The one exception was higher education, where the South did not do that much worse than the North.
Hmm.
But that's because who went to college?
Mm-hmm.
The University of North Carolina, University of Virginia,
yeah.
Very good schools, but they were filled with the sons and occasionally the daughters of rich whites. But overall, the South had much worse educational system, and Southern politicians fought against national policies intended to promote better education.
Why is that?
Their people were the ones who were going to benefit.
Yeah.
They did this because the best single predictor of whether a black person or a poor white was going to migrate out of the South was education. And it was also a predictor of political activism. Keeping blacks down meant keeping the schools, you know, reduced schooling for everybody. And also the people running the South, the rich were rich whites, racists, but they also didn't want to help poor whites either.
Let's go back, if I could, for a sec. So it seems like some of what happened to the South was a result of globalization, and some of that is because of things like satellite systems and fiber optic cables and shipping containers. But what you point out in the article is some of this was policy, and these policy decisions, for example, economic policies favoring Wall Street, were implemented by Democrats as well as Republicans. So to what – this is a question I've long wondered about. To what extent is this a sort of technological determinist result, or to what extent is this lots of policies that starting with Reagan and on through Clinton and then through the Obama administration and now in the Trump administration you have that have created these regional disparities?
Oh, it's. I would say it's all policy because trade is a policy decision.
Right.
We made a policy decision to open our markets to cheap textiles. We didn't have to do that. You know, we hadn't done it for decades. You know, actually for 150 years. So that was a policy decision, and there were policy decisions about tax policy. There were policy decisions about who was to get the benefits of automation and the new technologies. These technologies, most of which were developed by the federal government.
Right.
You take a cell phone, every technology in it, from the touch screen to the internet, to mobile communications, everything came from the federal government's research labs or research contracts. So this was a economic benefit that we all got because of where we put our government money.
So this didn't come from God. Men were sitting in a room and making these decisions.
And deciding that some people in Silicon Valley, in New York, in Boston, want to monopolize the benefits.
Right. Well, okay. So some of these economic policies, you argue, accelerate the decline in unionization. Why would the Democratic Party, and that was the base of the Democratic Party, why would leaders in the Democratic Party try to undermine the base?
Well, it was more negligent than active. Republicans actively undermined unions. But, you know, you come out in the mid-1970s, you know, the Democratic Party always relied on labor votes and, you know, in the 60s and early 70s, especially labor money and muscle. But the party was always beholden to, has always been beholden to, a sliver of the capitalist class, you know, especially high finance. You know, this is true in the Roosevelt years, too. So when you had a major economic crisis, as we had in the 1970s, with high inflation and slower economic growth, you know, the Democrats listened to the bankers. And their economist allies who were saying the problem is that wages are getting too high and you're undermining the capitalist system by letting unions have too much power. So the Democrats backed away from supporting unions and, you know, favored restrictive monetary policy, you know, which started with Carter.
Right.
And it was under Carter that they promoted deregulation of the trucking industry. And airlines, which devastated unions in those sectors. It was under Carter that the U.S. government really started to push for free trade internationally, which led to NAFTA eventually and the World Trade Organization. All that started with Carter. And it was listening to economists and Wall Street about what policies would promote faster economic growth and slower inflation. And it was devastating to the American working class. And as I said, especially to manual labor, manual workers who are concentrated in the South. We could have done things differently. We could have promoted unionization. We could have established a universal basic income, which, by the way, was a policy supported by Richard Nixon.
That's amazing. Ironic. Yeah, no, that's incredible. Yeah. So what have been the larger political implications of these of this growing disparity between regions?
Well, ironically, the regions that have been doing worst, you know, the regions of manual workers, material goods production, the industries that have been hurt the most by these economic changes have moved further and further away from the Democratic Party towards the Republicans. Mm-hmm. Part of this makes sense. I mean, they blame the Democrats because mm-hmm. Democrats are sort of guilty. Mm-hmm. But it's like, oh, my God, the worst thing the Democrats did was they adopted Republican policies.
Yeah, but don't the people, the voters in the South see that?
Well, another piece here is there are two other pieces here. One is that, you know, people have resorted to basic racism. Mm-hmm. And voting in the United States increasingly in the last 35 years, there was a little window in the 70s, and Jimmy Carter is an example of it, as was Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. There was a window that lasted into the 1990s where a biracial coalition of working class whites and black voters supported Democrats mm-hmm. with relatively moderate politics. Those people, those white Democrats are basically all gone.
Okay.
You know, there's no successor to Carter, Gore, Clinton, Riley of South Carolina, and Sam Nunn of Georgia. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, those whites are gone and there's nobody else. You know, now in the South, you're voting on racial lines. And this is also true nationally. One of the best predictors of individual voting in the recent elections, a stronger and stronger predictor over the last five or six elections, is attitudes on race. Mm-hmm. And the gap between voters for Obama and voters for Romney, or voters for Clinton and voters for Trump, is huge on that, much more than on economic policy. A lot of people voted for Trump thinking that he was a liberal on economic mm-hmm. policies.
Yeah.
After all, he promised to support Medicare. He wouldn't cut Medicare and Medicaid. He wouldn't cut Social Security. And he would restrict trade to benefit American workers. I mean, that kind of sounds a lot like Democratic politicians mm-hmm. pre-Carter.
Yeah.
So that's one factor. The second factor is increasingly people align their perspective on the economy and other issues with their partisan alignment. So people choose their party on the basis of race.
Yeah.
And then they view the economy through the prism of their party. You saw this dramatically in January 2017. If you saw polls of how Democrats and how Republicans mm-hmm. saw the economy, with Trump replacing Obama, Democrats' views of the economy plummeted and Republican views soared. You know, mm-hmm. and there are other issues like that. People choose their facts increasingly according to their partisanship. That's obviously very dangerous. It, to some degree, it reflects what media you watch,
right?
You follow. You know, if you view Fox News or you view the New York Times, you know, or MSNBC, then.
But that seems to imply that if Bernie were to try to push a Green New Deal in the South, it wouldn't make any difference. And even though it would help these industrial workers, they still wouldn't vote Democratic because they're voting along racial lines.
I'm afraid that there's a lot of truth in what you just said.
Okay.
I hope that it doesn't work out that way. But, you know, recently one of the Sanders campaign managers told somebody on 538.org that, oh, well, we're going to contest not just Iowa, but Montana.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, good luck. Yeah. You know, Montana did vote for Clinton in 92 and maybe 96. It used to have, you know, and Iowa was fairly Democratic,
sure,
too.
Sure, yeah.
But these states are looking out of reach. I mean, the Democratic Party right now is the party of social liberals and educated, which means affluent voters.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, you know, Democrats will say that for all sorts of things, a 70% marginal tax rate, you know, whatever. But, you know, when push comes to shove, the economic interests of a lot of Democratic voters may really start to come into play. I don't know if the flip side will be true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
I'd hope it would be.
We'll have to see. But, one thing is we're seeing this rise in the far right, in, like, you know, with Le Pen, and we're seeing it obviously in the UK. We saw it in Brazil, Poland, Turkey. But it seems like this is global. So what my question is, if American voters are voting along racial lines, and it seems like this dispossessed working class, white working class has moved to the right, why is that also happening in, you know, 9 or 10 other countries?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. And I think some of it is, you know, I hate to say that people are, you know, retreating into racism because of economic discontent. But, you know, that may be a part of it. If you look at the Brexit vote,
mm-hmm, right.
I mean, that I've looked at more than other things. You know, people with racially, you know, people hostile to immigrants, you know, people clutching their white Englishness mm-hmm. to their breasts, mm-hmm. you know, voted for Brexit, you know, to stop those immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could go on that. But
then doesn't that mean if you give people jobs, then that racism, you know, doesn't completely disappear, but they stop embracing as much?
I would hope so.
Okay.
And that's something that we can do. You know, I think also it's an argument for making programs universal.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems in America, as you know, in England after Thatcher, Britain after Thatcher also had this, you know, means testing social benefits
mm-hmm.
leads inevitably, since minorities tend to be poorer, women tend to be poorer, it leads inevitably to a sense among white male workers that, oh, those people are getting more benefits. Well, yeah, they are, because they're means tested and they're poor.
Mm.
But, you know, it promotes that hostility. Social Security and Medicare have not had the same type of negative political reaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the contrary, they've promoted solidarity, as has the National Health Service in Britain. Because everybody gets it, even though, you know, if you get down to it, the biggest beneficiaries of Social Security, Medicare are, you know, poor people also.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. you know, they benefit people in Mississippi more than they benefit people in Manhattan, you know, in the east side of New York.
Right.
The east side of New York, they don't need it.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter, but,
right.
you know, but it does tie the country together. So I think that and Bernie has been very good on this in pushing how we need to make some of these programs universal. Universal free college, you know, which will not only help the economy, but will particularly, you know, tie people together, you know, rebuild solidarity. So, I mean, that's what we can do. In
mm-hmm.
the short term, you know, we're between this rock and a hard place. I mean, it's no accident that Democrats keep running towards candidates like Hillary Clinton, who, you know, is a very nice person. I have a lot of respect for her. But, you know, she's very careful not to antagonize the people who go to Davos for that World Economic Conference of rich people, of super rich people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, regardless of anything else, just seeing Democrats associating with, you know, these Silicon Valley billionaires antagonizes people who are feeling left behind.